On the 10th of August, the fleet was ready to depart from Seville. Only Magellan remained behind, making last-minute provisioning arrangements. He would join the fleet shortly before its final departure from Spain. A week after leaving Seville, the Armada de Mallorca reached the snug coastal town of Sanlúcar de Barrameda, the final point of departure for the Ocean Sea. Beyond the huddled town lay the churning waters of the Atlantic. Many ships had departed from Sanlúcar de Barrameda, and some had been fortunate enough to return from distant ports and newly discovered lands, but none had circumnavigated the entire world. Magellan took command of his fleet just before departure and made sure that his sailors led a pious existence during what might be their last days on land. Pigafetta wrote, "We remained for some days at the port to hear Mass on land at a church named Our Lady of Barrameda near Sanlúcar, where the Captain General ordered all those of the fleet to confess themselves before going farther. Moreover, he would not allow any woman, whoever she might be, to come onto the fleet and to the ships, for many good reasons." Magellan's autocratic style extended beyond religious observance. To stifle dissent, Pigafetta wrote, Magellan concealed the ultimate goal of the expedition from his rank-and-file sailors. This assertion needs clarification. As a Portuguese mariner, Magellan was accustomed to secrecy when it came to voyages of discovery. That was the Portuguese way, yet everyone realized that the fleet was bound for the Spice Islands. It was even called the Armada de Mallorca. Perhaps Pigafetta meant that Magellan wished to keep his plan to find a strait, a waterway leading to the east, to himself until it was too late for disloyal crew members to desert. In the pages of his diary, Pigafetta confided another and far more troubling reason for Magellan's unusual secrecy. "The masters and captains of the other ships of this company loved him not. I do not know the reason, unless it be that he, the captain general, was Portuguese, and they were Spaniards and Castilians, which peoples have long borne ill will and malevolence towards one another." To assert his authority over his resentful and contentious captains, Magellan gave strict sailing orders designed to reinforce his unquestioned command. The most innocuous aspect of his standing orders, the requirement that all ships report to Trinidad at dusk, rankled the captains the most because it demonstrated that Magellan, and no one else, served as the leader of the Armada de Mallorca. Leaving the mouth of the Guadalquivir River on September 20th, 1519, the five ships of the Armada plunged into the Atlantic Ocean. It was a dream as old as the imagination, a voyage to the ends of the earth. Yet until the age of discovery, it remained only a dream. At the time, Europe was deeply ignorant of the world at large. Magellan undertook his ambitious voyage in a world ruled by superstition, populated with strange and demonic creatures, and reverberating with a longing for religious redemption. To the average person, the world beyond Europe resembled the fantastic realms depicted in The Thousand and One Nights, a collection of tales including The Seven Voyages of Sinbad the Sailor. Going to sea was the most adventurous thing one could do. In the age of discovery, more than half the earth was unexplored, unmapped, and misunderstood by Europeans. Mariners feared they could literally sail over the edge of the world. They believed that sea monsters lurked in the briny depths, waiting to devour them. And when they crossed the equator, the ocean would boil and scald them to death. Some of the most tenacious ideas about the world at large derive from Pliny the Elder, who died in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 AD. His multi-volume encyclopedic Natural History, rediscovered and widely consulted in the Renaissance, sought to bring together everything that was known about the natural world: mountains, continents, flora, and fauna. Pliny's chapters on humankind contained a potent mixture of fact and fantasy. He wrote of a tribe known as the Arimaspi, a people known for having one eye in the middle of the forehead. He confidently cited other classical authorities, such as Herodotus, who related tales of a continual battle between the Arimaspi and griffins in the vicinity of the latter's mines. while it might have generated some skepticism among naturalists of Magellan's time, it was generally accepted as fact, as was Pliny's curious description of forest dwellers who have their feet turned back behind their leg. India offered particularly fertile ground for extraordinary creatures. Pliny evoked men with dog's heads who are covered with wild beast skins. They bark instead of speaking and live by hunting and fowling, for which they use their nails. At one time, says Pliny, over 120,000 of these hominids flourished throughout India. In the open waters of the ocean lurked even more bizarre creatures, whales and sharks, 6-foot-long lobsters and 300-foot-long eels. Sailors had no way of telling which of Pliny's descriptions were reliable and which were fantasies. A work published in 1560 contained descriptions of various sea monsters infesting the oceans. One, known as the whirlpool, was said to have a human countenance. Another, supposedly sighted in 1531, had hideous scaly skin. There were others, the satyr of the sea, the rusmarus, which rivaled an elephant in size, and the wondrous scolopendra, with its face of flames. Voyagers across the seas, especially those attempting to circumnavigate the globe, could expect to encounter all these creatures and more in the course of their journey. John Mandeville served as a great traveler and storyteller of the era. With suave assurance, he deftly mixed accounts from ancient authors with what he claimed were his personal experiences. But Mandeville was actually a compiler rather than a traveler, and he drew much of his material directly from Speculum Mundi, a medieval encyclopedia which contained extracts from Pliny and Marco Polo, among other authorities. Sailors setting out to sea with Magellan paid special attention to Mandeville's unnerving descriptions of powerful magnetic rocks capable of destroying unwary ships, warning of great sea rocks of the stone that is called adamant, which draws iron. In consequence, there should pass no ships that had nails of iron their way because of the foresaid stone, for he should draw them to him, therefore they dare not wend thither. If they did, the magnetic rock would draw the nails from the hulls, and the ships would leak and even sink. Mandeville argued that it was possible for people to circumnavigate the globe, but, he warned, there are so many routes and countries where a man can go wrong except by special grace of God. He proposed one man who had accomplished the trick. He passed India and so many isles beyond India, where there are more than 5,000 isles, and traveled so far by land and sea, girdling the globe, that he found an isle where he heard his own language being spoken, Mandeville wrote. He marveled greatly, for he did not understand how that could be, but I conjecture that he had traveled so far over land and sea, circumnavigating the earth, that he had come to his own border. If he had gone a bit further, he would have come to his own district. But after he heard that marvel, he could not get transport any further, so he turned back the way he had come. So he had a long journey. Accounts of the natural world circulating throughout Europe were so terrifying and fantastic that François Rabelais, the French friar and physician turned popular author, enthusiastically satirized them in his comic epic Gargantua and Pantagruel, which appeared as a series of books beginning in 1532. Rabelais mocked unreliable accounts with his own farcical version of exotic lands and the strange creatures to be found there. Among his authorities on the world was a blind old hunchback called Hearsay, who possessed 7 tongues, each divided into 7 parts, and maintained a school. In Rabelais' hands, this figure becomes a vicious parody of a cosmologist and his entourage of flunkies. Around him, I saw innumerable men and women listening to him attentively, and among the group I recognized several with very important looks. They spoke about the pyramids, the Nile, Babylon, the troglodytes, the hymenopteres, the blemmii, the pygmies, the cannibals, the Hyperborean mountains, the Egyptians, and all the devils, and all from hearsay. Rabelais had a serious point to make. He was directing his readers back to the classical Greek concept of autopsis, seeing for oneself. Autopsis stressed the value of firsthand reporting. This was a revolutionary concept in the age of discovery, to go see for oneself, to study the world as it was, not as myths and sacred texts suggested that it should be. And that was exactly what Magellan proposed to do. He would see for himself if there was a water route to the Spice Islands. He would find the strait leading to them, if it existed, and then he would report back to King Charles on his findings. So Magellan stood on the knife edge, dividing the ancient and medieval worlds from the modern. His voyage would be a completely practical and empirical approach to discovery. He would go and see for himself, the first ever global autopsis. The reign of hearsay was coming to an end.